This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
You have my sword. And you have my bow.
And my axe.
Welcome back to another episode of Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at the little-known cult trilogy, Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson's surprise sleepy hit from the early 2000s. We'll go over a little bit of news first, talk a little bit about the movie and our thoughts, and then get stuck into the science that these movies bring up, including, but not limited to two, the concept of deforestation, allegories for environmental degradation in film, and the concept of dichotomous ecosystems, or edge specialists. As always, this show is going to be broken up into a few different segments. We'll have time codes below so you can skip ahead to the bits you're looking for. But before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I am a freshwater / invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside co-host Adam Harsick. Are you finally done?
I've technically been done in Arkansas since the end of August, but we have officially moved out of Arkansas. I am now in a transitional limbo at my parents' house in Missouri, and as of this coming Friday, October 1st, I will be flying to Israel.
God damn. The Ben-Gurion University of the Negev.
Ben-Gurion sounds like a fucking bogan town in the bush.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? One of those towns that, you know, used to have a lovely name, came from one of Australia's indigenous languages, but now is just being corrupted by a bunch of fucking rednecks.
Wagga Wagga.
Wagga Wagga. Wollongong. The Gong, as they call it.
Wollongong.
That is us today. We are quarant with two. Her ladyship, Libby Young, is off learning to play golf. Or is it croquet?
It might be crochet. That one does involve needles.
And Dave. Where's Dave?
I think Dave has posted up outside of the farm supply store, and he's literally fighting off all of the conservative idiots trying to get ivermectin.
Okay.
Hand-to-hand combat. Because, you know, the livestock need this livestock dewormer.
Yeah. So, we're talking a little bit about deforestation today, and in some of the fight against deforestation, Adam, who is it?
Hawaii, the island state in the U.S., and not to be confused with Puerto Rico, the other island-based protectorate of the United States. It is the most isolated island in the world, fun fact. But they have pledged to conserve, restore, or grow 100 million trees by 2030 as part of a global 1 trillion tree effort.
Yeah, the 1 trillion trees thing is a source of a lot of controversy for people because it was a paper a while ago, I think 2 or 3 years back, right? By an American group that said, hey, if we plant 1 trillion trees, we'll solve climate change. A lot of people have come out and said, no, that's not how this works.
It's not how that works at all.
Yeah, and one of the big problems with this is that, you know, we don't want monocultures. And when people do mass tree planting schemes, a lot of the time it does result in monocultures. And it's a big kind of constant ongoing debate because, yes, absolutely, there are certain trees which are better at sucking up carbon and storing carbon, but they often don't lead to biodiversity. And we are in a massive biodiversity crisis as well. It's not just the climate that's suffering. So,
we really are. And for those of you at home, monoculture, again, is just this idea that you have a single species or a very, very small amount of species spread across a massive landscape. Think about any enormous amounts of North America are just cornfields, just agricultural farms that are full of corn. And because... Yeah. There aren't a lot of other different plants that other animals and other plants and fungi can then specialize off of or live with. You really limit what kind of biodiversity can inhabit those areas.
A lot of invasive species, plant species, will often set up massive monocultures. In Norway, we have massive problems with garden lupin, or hager lupin as it's called here, where it'll get into a field and all of a sudden in 2 or 3 years, it's just that everywhere.
Really?
And it ruins biodiversity. It can really knock out native pollinators as well. So it reduces your pollination pollinator biodiversity, which then goes ahead and reduces bird biodiversity, small insect, small animal biodiversity.
It's probably not dissimilar to what we have in the southeastern parts of the United States with kudzu, which is an invasive Japanese plant. Oh. I think it's Japanese, that has just taken over entire parts of the countryside. It's just, yeah. I have very distinct memories of just driving along the road and just these sheets of kudzu going all the way up to the power lines. And it's just, it looks like somebody literally took a green blanket and laid it down on top of the forest. Like, it smothers everything.
Yeah. Yeah, the kudzu thing is, like, in a different class to the Hagalupin problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, that thing is, it's incredible. The photos I've seen are just, it's like something out of a, you know, those kind of futuristic images you see of, like, the plants taking over after humanity's died and, you know, burnt in hell.
It's that, but real.
That is, yeah, exactly. That's what it reminds me of. Now I'm just a mean green mother from outer space and I'm dead. So, yeah, today we are looking at Lord of the Rings, a massive, sprawling epic. One of the best examples of, I don't know, a pretty essentialist battle between good and evil.
Yep.
Set in a slightly fantastical, I think it's sort of an analog for Middle Ages Europe. Yeah. And the essence of the plot is you have Sauron, the big bad, who pours all his evil and malice into a ring, which pops up and is definitely in no way similar to a Horcrux whatsoever. J.K. Rowling definitely did not steal that idea at all. This ring needs to be dropped into the volcano in which it was forged, and thus starts the epic quest of the Fellowship of the Ring to deliver said ring into a volcano.
Mount Doom.
I led Isildur into the heart of Mount Doom, where the ring was forged, the one place it could be destroyed.
It's just Adam and I today, so we're not going to go into the whole what we liked, what we didn't like. We'll do that next week, because we are doing a second episode on this next week.
Bit of a two-parter.
What we thought we'd talk about today is just which of the three films we love the most, because, spoiler alert, we both really love these films and have done for, you know, the best part of two decades.
They're great fucking films.
So, Adam, do you want to go first? What's your favorite of the three?
I'd be happy to. I think, for me, my favorite has always been The Two Towers. As much as I enjoy The Fellowship, because it's just so, everything is wholesome and green and magical. You're kind of being exposed to this world for the first time if you haven't read the books. But The Two Towers is just so epic in scale. It really opens the world up, and you get to see a bit more of Middle Earth. And then this insane climax all coming down to the Battle of Helm's Deep at the end of the movie. And it's just such a huge, sweeping, epic movie, and it really comes to a head of that battle, and I love it. I can't get enough of it. It's probably the one I've seen the most. I know it's my favorite. I touched on The Fellowship being kind of the green, fun, wholesome beginning to the series, and as much as I enjoy Return of the King, it's much more it's almost an epilogue itself with about four or five different endings to the movie itself. There's other big battles, like the battle at Minas Tirith, which is also a enormous, beautiful, incredibly impressive achievement technologically and cinema, as far as cinematography goes, but it all really boils down to The Two Towers for me.
I think I would have agreed with you until about 5 years ago. I think I love The Two Towers. It is still the one I've seen the most, but I really just love the wholesomeness and like the introduction you get into that world of Fellowship. So I think over the last 4 or 5 years I've switched to enjoying Fellowship a lot more. I love the climax to it. Boromir's death is still, I think, my favorite death of a character in cinema. That just the quickest redemption arc you've ever seen in your goddamn life.
Yeah,
building up to be a villain the entire time, and then just, you know, earning it back by protecting Merry and Pippin for a little.
I think that's the one of the very few things I feel like the movies got wrong compared to the representation of characters in the books, because Boromir's just kind of shown as this prick who just really wants it for himself and for his own people, but he is like the man amongst men in this world. Like, he is the hero's hero. He's such a good person who really wants to save everything, and he is corrupted by the absolute evil that is the ring. And the book, I think, does a much better job of kind of showing that descent and showing like what kind of person he was. And the movies did show this. In the extended edition, you see a bit of him kind of being the savior of the people, this scene when they're taking Osgiliath back from the orcs, which is a city close to Minas Tirith. But it was cut from the theatrical releases, so you just really get to see Boromir be this dick who gets killed, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, I have always thought that these are one of the biggest, the best examples of an amazing series of books that were translated to an amazing series of films.
Agreed.
Do you have any big issues with the translation from book to film? Because, full disclosure, I haven't read these books since I was about 13.
I read them a few times. Most recently, I went through them last year with Libby, the Baroness. I feel at times they don't really do a good enough job of selling how scary the bad guys are. Like, the Ringwraiths are in the Fellowship are, you know, intimidating. They are pretty intense. But Tolkien, who is not what I would consider a horror writer by any means, there's a scene in the Fellowship where they're hiding out at this safe house on the other side of the Shire. And he's just describing like this creeping dread and this feeling of evil as one of these Ringwraiths is like closing in on their house, like looking for them. And just the way he describes how it moves, and it's like just this creeping darkness that is personified in this Ringwraith. I feel that doesn't really get a fair shake in the movies, but by and large, I feel like this is one of, if not the absolute best depiction of a work of fiction on the screen.
Yeah, I agree. This and... I don't necessarily think these are better than the books, but this and Jurassic Park are always the big two examples I always use of, you know, amazing translations of something to film.
Yeah.
All right, so for trivia this week, I said before that Adam has, you know, read the Lord of the Rings books more recently, but you've also extensively dived into, like, the other fictional works that Tolkien wrote about Middle-earth, right?
Yeah, for those of you who don't know at home, Tolkien wrote more than The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. He also wrote Children of Húrin, Beren and Lúthien, The Lay of Beren and Lúthien, The Silmarillion, which is basically the Bible for the world of Middle-earth, the creation story, talking about all the gods and the Valar and the Maiar, basically Tolkien's versions of gods, angels, demons, and all the races they create. So those stories are very full-blown. He really did the Baroness can do a much better job at describing these terms and this kind of the structure than I can as far as literal creation, but literary creation, not literal. But he set up this entire foundation for a world that then the Lord of the Rings are, the series is a part of. And that's just one small part towards the end of this incredible epic history that has gone on through Middle Earth. So the end of the Lord of the Rings movies is the end of what's called the Third Age. So that means there's at least two more ages before that, which are enormous and large and full of content. But as far as trivia,
yeah.
I just want to touch on like three fun things from the from kind of that backstory in the history of this world. The first one being the orcs. They mentioned in the movies that the orcs are kind of the creation of elves being taken and tortured. Tolkien kind of contradicts himself a little bit in the history of these books with saying how they came about exactly, where either the evil god Melkor or Morgoth, as he became, who was basically Sauron's boss, he basically created them. That is one of the versions. Another one is that he just kind of took these elves, tortured them, bred them, and basically kind of experimented with them until he ended up with orcs. So for us, think about this from a scientific point of view, orcs are basically the result of artificial selection in a terrible breeding program, taking these beautiful elves, these immortal creatures who are basically angels, and making them into these mortal, twisted, broken things that are evil.
Mm. Okay.
So that's one of them. Second one would be this dragon known as Encalagon the Black. We know Smaug from the Hobbit movies and the Hobbit book itself, but Smaug is a very large dragon played by Sir Benedict Cumberbatch. I don't know if he's a knight yet. He probably will be eventually. But with motion capture and everything, which is really weird for that movie. You don't need to be motion capturing that dragon. If anything,
yeah. If you haven't seen it, please go and Google Benedict Cumberbatch Smaug motion capture. It's wild shit.
But Encalagon was one of the last hopes of Morgoth, Sauron's boss. Remember the big bad, the former big bad, who's even worse than Sauron back in the Second Age. And they were having this fight with the elves and the dwarves and the men. You know, the good versus evil. And he was kind of on the ropes, so he released his trump card, this fleet of dragons that he had doing his bidding. And the largest of them, and the leader of them, was Encalagon the Black, who is described as big as a mountain. So a dragon, the literal size of a mountain, which we talked about this before. Creatures cannot get that big, but it's fun to think about in an organism so big that it destroyed mountains when it was killed and it fell on them. As I think as Sam described it in our chat before the podcast, the size of Poland. And I think I can't disagree with that.
Very big mountain. What's the one on Mars?
I think it's Mons Olympus. Yeah, it's the biggest mountain in the galaxy. Yeah. It's like 5 miles, 7.5 kilometers high.
Yeah, 21.9 kilometers high.
I lied.
Jesus Christ. Okay, and then you had a third one?
Yeah, third one being another one of those forerunners to a character you might be more familiar with from the movies and or the Lord of the Rings books, is Ungoliant, who was the mother of Shelob, and basically this manifestation of evil in the form of a spider. And she had, there was basically a deal made between her and Morgoth for her to like do some bidding for him. She did it, and he kind of reneged on the deal and used his army of Balrogs to drive her off. So we see how fearsome one Balrog in the movies was. Imagine a fleet of them being used to drive off this gigantic, pissed off spider. She was basically described as being incredibly hungry all the time. And in the books, they describe her as seeking out mates just to mate with them, eat them, and then consume her own offspring whenever they came out, which is one of those things I think we might not have mentioned too much as far as from an ecological sense, but producing offspring to then eat them might seem like a, quote, smart idea because you're making your own food, but energy doesn't work like that, and it's a really stupid idea because you are literally making your own food that you then have to consume just to try to break even, which you wouldn't because you're going to be burning energy creating these offspring. You're not even going to get back to where you were. You're just losing energy doing that.
Yeah. Think if you've, had a kid yourself or known anybody who has a kid, think about how much, a pregnant woman eats. And it's more than a baby's worth. I apologize for putting that image in your head.
It's a lot more than a baby's worth, even a very big baby.
Sydney, can you leave some for us? I thought you were trying to lose weight.
Lay off me, I'm starving.
Before we start looking at the science, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat or game with us on Discord. Just type in cinematicaanimalia and you'll find us. If you want to read Libby's work, visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear about some of the less movie-related ecology that Adam, I, and a huge team of international writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasters.com. And as always, if you enjoy the podcast, give us an in-app rating. It really helps. Leave a review. Suggest a monster. We're always on the lookout for fan suggestions.
Yes, please send us an email. Tell your friends about us. It's fun.
Yes. Okay, so today I kind of want to start off talking about just we're going to go into more detail on the actual creatures themselves, like potentially the Balrog, the spiders, the ringwraith steeds next week. But we just want, the big flying ones, not the horses.
The nightmare beast.
Yeah, we're going to talk about horses. Were those realistic horses? Do horses look like that? What are some of the dangers of... No, we'll do that.
Horses are very dangerous.
They are. Zebras and donkeys, especially. I mean, they're not actually horses.
Zebras are dicks.
They are such a pack of assholes, yeah. But what I wanted to talk about today was one of the things that first hit me when I was watching this, because, like I said earlier, this is kind of pitched as an analogue to Middle Age Europe, or at least pre-industrialization Europe, I would say.
Yes.
So, where the fuck are all the animals? Because we are presented with these ecosystems on a constant basis, and they seem to be entirely devoid of animal life. The only really hint we get of other animal species existing in these worlds are when they're killed or eaten. So,
which is very rare.
Sam hunting down, as he puts it, a brace of conies.
Gollum found those.
Oh, yes, good point. Yep. Gollum found a couple of fish as well at various points throughout the film. And we see a lot of megafauna as well. We see the Olyphants, as Sam calls them.
A big, like, rhino monster that was bred in Mordor for the use of dragging the battering ram from Minas Tirith.
Yeah. And we see a few other things, but it's very low on animal life. And this isn't completely ridiculous. I mean, and obviously, you know, you can't pack a you can't pack modern forests with animals purely for the purpose of shooting a movie, of course. But there is a somewhat of a misconception about our activities in Europe pre-industrialization. So there's a lot of people who think that in the industrial age, turn of the century around the early 1800s.
Early 1900s, late 1800s.
When the industrial age hit, that's when we really started fucking ecosystems up. But deforestation was happening well before then. Humans have lived in agricultural societies for at least 3,000 years in Europe. Before the industrial age kicked in, deforestation was a huge part of that. Before we'd even reach the end of the 1800s, just as an example here, Ireland's forest cover had gone down to 0%. Denmark's had dropped from mid-20s to well below 10%. France's forest cover, enormous fucking country, had gone from about 50% to hanging around 10%. Deforestation was already widespread at that point.
Yep.
So it's not unreasonable to think that, I mean, because men are fairly, I mean, they are, it's not a particularly densely populated world from what we can see, right, Adam?
It doesn't really seem to be. You have like population centers, but much like medieval or pseudo medieval Europe, people live in very small villages of maybe 20 to 30 people, maybe four or five families, yeah, live in a little area doing their own little thing, and they will then go to maybe a market town, and that will then be maybe 300 or 400 people maximum, and you only have a couple cities, yeah, like Minas Tirith that have, you know, thousands of people.
For instance, an example of the 300 or 400 would potentially be, is it Bree?
Bree.
You see at the start of, yeah.
Yeah, the human town on the outskirts of the Shire.
Yeah. But even areas like that are quite capable of causing quite a bit of deforestation, and it may not be as widespread as we've seen before. I mean, there are certainly patches of forest that are still obviously extant. You see the hobbits traveling through one of these kind of forested areas on the way from the Shire to Bree, but even the Shire itself, you can see that they have created massive monocultures there. The hobbits do a fairly good job. I mean, they are seen as, you know, living in harmony with nature, but they still have, I mean, they're an agrarian society.
Yeah.
They have massive portions of land that they've presumably cleared for farming. And we'll get into environmental degradation and allegories later on, but it's not impossible to think that they have, you know, destroyed forests to the point where some bird life and mammal life has, you know, already learned to be in fear of these things. And we don't see them hunting too actively.
But they would have had to have been. They're not. I think they're getting more, especially the more rural hobbits, like Farmer Maggot, who you see towards the at the end of the first act of the Fellowship of the Ring. He's living in the country, yep, the country of the country. So at the, yep, very least, there's probably going to be some extra hunting to supplement his table.
Yeah, yeah, you would think so. And I mean, the men obviously that are living fairly close in the village we talked about earlier, Bree, they're probably hunting as well. So it's not unreasonable to think that already at this point, animals have definitely learned to fear humans.
As always, I mean,
yeah,
there's hunters, there's gonna be trappers. This is the time, this is a culture where you have, it's a profession, being a hunter or a trapper. You go out, yeah, you kill animals, you bring them to market, and people buy meat from you, yeah, or the pelts or the furs. Yeah.
And these are potentially even new growth forests. So we've talked about this misconception a bunch of times before, that Europe is filled with forests. Which, you know, places like Norway, Sweden, Germany, that's true. There's forests everywhere. But a lot of them are not what we consider old growth forests. They're new growth forests that's been replanted much more recently. And they're nowhere near as biodiverse. Old growth forest is
dense.
Yeah, absolutely. It's dense. There's rotted woody logs there, which create massive amounts of biodiversity, insect life. And as we were talking about before, when you get more biodiverse insects, you get more biodiverse birds, you get more biodiverse small mammal life and reptile life.
That's the circle of life.
But we were mentioning the ants before. Potentially in Fangorn Forest, if the ants are incredibly voracious predators, that is one reason why we might not see anything in Fangorn Forest. But you would think that in a place like that, there would be life everywhere, because that is clearly depicted as old growth forest, I would say.
Wild, Fangorn, untamed, thick. Yeah, old growth forest.
Yeah, So no moose moving around in there. That really annoys me that we don't actually see any moose for some reason. We see a giant elk in the Hobbit movies, though.
Yeah, that's what Teruviel, right, it's not Teruviel. Thranduil, Legolas' father, the king of the forest elves.
Yeah. But yeah, there is a big difference between old growth and new growth forests. And so just because you have a densely forested area doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be incredibly biodiverse and filled with life. So, while we're on that, Fangorn Forest is one of the primary examples of this concept in this film, whereby you just have these completely dichotomous ecosystems, where there's no transition from one to another. Like, Fangorn Forest goes from, I would say, scrub grassland, just to forest, and, like, is a line. It's a line in the sand. It doesn't really happen like that in real life, right?
No, you have very gradual transitions from one type of ecosystem to another. You don't have, like, it's not like a video game, like fucking Don't Starve, never play that game, it's so impossible, where you have literal swamp, and there's a black line, and next to that is the forest ecosystem, and then next to that is the grassland ecosystem. It just doesn't work like that.
It's kind of, it reminds me of Star Wars syndrome, like where you have entire planets that are just one ecosystem. Like here, it's just like a block of swamp. And then, you know, somebody's put up a block of forest next to that. Like, they go from this, like, bolded, mountainous, rugged hill area, and then it's just swamp immediately.
Yeah. The video game Valheim that we, Libby, Dave, and I have played actually does a fairly decent job of this kind of gradual transition, because you have, like, the grassland-type, thinner, forested area, which then transitions into the Black Forest, which is, like, the thicker, more old-growth-type forest. They're built in such a way that it seems a transition, even though it is a very stark delineation between the two habitats.
It annoyed me in this a little more because there are many, many species have evolved to take advantage of these transition areas. They're called edge specialists. So it's creatures that exist so that they can take advantage of perhaps one resource that is found in one of these ecosystems and a resource that is found in another of these ecosystems. So, and I always bring it back to these things because I studied them and I think they're really cool. Moose. Moose are a really good example of an edge specialist in modern day Norway, because they love grazing on grass, but grass open areas provide no cover whatsoever. So the resource that they get from open fields is grass. The resource that they get from heavily wooded forest is shelter. And so they spend a lot of time at the edge of these two ecosystems trying to take advantage of them both. And we don't see anything like that at all. Again, it goes to the whole thing of you can't just, you know, have massive amounts of creatures running around. Well, you couldn't back then anyway. I guess CGI would probably do a pretty good job of it these days. But yeah, I would really like to see what sort of edge specialists somebody like Tolkien would come up with in an ecosystem like this.
I wonder, because I mean, I feel like to that point, he doesn't really have too many creatures he's made up. It seems to be mainly normal, our version of normal animals, like the animals we're used to seeing, deer, rabbits, fish.
Yeah.
And then you have the occasional like monster, like an ent, or the beasts that the Ringwraiths ride, which are, I think, implied to have been created. And a lot of the creatures that are also implied to be created, like in Mordor. But beyond that, it seems fairly straightforward as far as the animal life you might expect. So there should be something like a moose or, you know, another large cervid specializing on those two habitat borders.
Yeah, and we see the Irish elk or the giant elk. I would have liked some more of that. Also, predators. Like, where are the wild predators? Why? I mean, those hobbits are tiny. Why are they not more afraid when they're coming out into the woods?
I don't think it's ever implied that the wolves were hunted to extinction, but that might be a reason. That might be something that's happened.
It could happen.
Much like conflict between the farmers and, predators here, in both in North America and in Northern Europe. It's always been a problem. Yeah.
And as we've said before, I mean, just because something's a vicious predator doesn't mean that it's not shit scared of humans. Most things are shit scared of humans.
For good
reason. Apart from, as we've mentioned before, you know, some things like zebras and hippos.
They're scared of nothing.
Yeah. Fangorn, though, is the main culprit here, because I mean, you even have a couple of like panning shots where the camera moves into Fangorn and everything just changes immediately. Now, forests are capable of producing like really interesting microclimates, right? But there's no, it's just like night and day. Like, you go into this place and 10 meters in, you think you're in a completely different world. It's a little bit, over the top. Yeah,
you have contiguous bands of habitat because, for whatever reason, the climate is right for it. The various biotic conditions are right for these organisms, be they plant, fungi, animals, whatever. But you have some that are a bit better or a bit more tolerant of adverse conditions than others. And that's why you have, towards the edge of like a forest, if it's not cultivated by humans, kind of this like scattering and thinning of the forest as you go further and further away from the core, because it's less and less suitable. But some of those plants can then still take advantage of it, but it's not as many as you have towards the core.
Really interesting ecological theory is that because when you get further away from the core, you tend to get a little bit more genetic diversity in species. Mm-hmm. And so we have at some point seen that when humans have come in and caused massive die-offs, be it environmental degradation, introduction of invasive species, it's often groups or populations of a species at the edge that will survive for a little bit longer because they have a little more genetic diversity and can therefore adapt to change a little better. Yeah. Again, only a theory. We haven't killed enough species quite yet to have the necessary data. But we're getting there.
A scientific theory, not the colloquial use of the word theory. So we have like these dichotomous environments between like Fangorn, like the grasslands of Rohan, abutting this thick old growth forest of Fangorn with this sharp line you can walk right down, which is, I think, the same you have with the Mirkwood, the forest that Legolas is from. It's the same thing. This old growth, thick, crazy, scary forest right next to a grassland. It's fine. And you have Beorn, that big, maybe he's a man, who knows, that lives right outside. It's like a werebear type thing in this rolling field of beautiful, you know, grassland. But you also have everything from Mordor is spiky, black, sinister looking, and just seems to have been made perfectly for this black, sinister, spiky environment. And I think, much like the orcs being created by some kind of artificial breeding program and horrible experimentation, all of these creatures are the result of artificial selection. You have some kind of, you know, overseer, somebody in charge of these programs to make these creatures, and they are then selecting for traits that various offspring are showing or producing, and then those are the ones that allow them to then breed, and they keep producing maybe more and more exaggerated or more and more distinguished versions of this. I don't know if they mention it in the movies, but I think it's just the books, but they talk about the ringwraiths, the horses that they ride are bred. They're from Rohan, but they're then either trained in Rohan specifically or then bred further in Mordor to then be able to get them used to being around the ringwraiths, because everything living hates the ringwraiths because they're not right. They're evil. They exude this feeling of unease and terror and everything wrong with the world. And so horses are incredibly skittish by nature. You try getting a fucking ghost to ride on its back, good luck.
It's one of the reasons that zebras are dicks.
Oh, they're even worse.
These Oreo donkeys are one of the most homicidal animals that no one ever expects.
We did talk a little bit about environmental messaging in films when we looked at Princess Mononoke earlier this year. But I wanted to come back to it because Tolkien's really interesting when it comes to environmental messaging in these movies. Because he has specifically said that... And he was miserable about the fact that so much of England's forest was destroyed. He mentions this in a foreword to one of the editions of Lord of the Rings that came out. Basically talks about the fact that he had to watch his country destroyed by deforestation from a very early age. Nothing compared to what's happening these days in terms of planetary, worldwide destruction. But still, he was quite heartbroken by it. However, Tolkien has maintained that he dislikes allegory, and I'm quoting here from that same foreword, dislikes allegory in all its manifestations and has always done so since he grew old and wary enough to detect his presence. As for any meaning or message, it has in the intention of the author none. So he is insistent that there was no allegory for environmental destruction in these movies. But I mean, there fucking is, right?
I mean, there absolutely is, but I think the point there is that his version of what allegory is like, you're a bad writer if I can detect this, and it's very over the top, and it's very like a ham-fisted attempt at environmental messaging. But I think what he might be doing is it's a bit more subtle, and it's not necessarily beating over the head with, like, environmental destruction, it's bad. It's just, well, of course it's bad. Like, the while, you know, the natural world is beautiful and amazing, and why would you not want to experience that? Why would you destroy that? I think it's just coming from the point of view of describing what should be an objective good versus really hitting you over the head with, like, oh, the environmental destruction's bad, and this is my bird. This is me showing you this is bad. But yeah, it's very clear. I mean, at least in the movies, it's very clear. I think in the books, they also, it's pretty clear that the orcs, one of the reasons the orcs and Saruman in particular are bad is because they're destroying the natural world to then reap its resources.
Yeah. And I think that's, because let's go through it in terms of subtlety and look at the different kind of species or races of humanoids in Middle Earth. The most obvious example is, as you said, Saruman and the orcs. I mean, tearing down the forest. That's the most in-your-face that it gets.
He is then directing the orcs and the ones he's bred, the Uruk-hai, which are even crazier, to tear down Fangorn Forest, fuel their fires, completely destroy Isengard, which is this amazing and beautiful garden, into this hellscape of industrialization.
Yeah. And it's... Yeah, that... And you really get the feeling... When you say hellscape, and that's what you get the feeling of, these enormous caverns full of metal and fire and that sort of thing. It's the only point in any of these three films where I feel like it really hits you on the head. But I think the more obvious message, well, not the more obvious message, but a message that was very ahead of its time is the Moria story. Dwarves being greedy, digging for more and more, and eventually releasing, you know, this force that wipes them out and leads to the destruction. How's that portrayed in the book? Is that as clearly... Because I think that's an allegory that's very ahead of its time for climate change in particular.
You know, I've never, until you mentioned that in this episode, I've never really thought about that being a good allegory for climate change and for especially drilling into the earth. But it's always been more portrayed as there are places on earth that you're not supposed to go because there is old evil and stuff that's been sleeping for a very long time. In this case, a Balrog, a literal, this crazy, powerful demon from the olden times, like the first or the second age. Remember, the army of Balrogs is what drove off Ungoliant from Morgoth. But it's definitely more portrayed as these dwarves, they knew better. They know there's probably bad things down in certain parts of the world, but they're greedy. And that's how the dwarves are always portrayed. They want more and more mineral wealth just so they can have it. They don't necessarily use it to enrich anybody else. The dwarves, like in most fantasy, are shown to be not necessarily capricious, but they're greedy, they want shiny things, and they want it for themselves. They're magpies. Dwarves are magpies.
My favorite line about dwarves is from Terry Pratchett's Discworld, where he says, "Dwarves don't actually love gold. That's just what they tell it to get it into bed."
That's pretty good.
Yeah, so the dwarves, obviously, are bad. Saruman and the orcs, bad. Hobbits, though. We talked about this earlier. I mean, they seem to be a fairly peaceful society, but again, they have created massive monocultures. We see farmer maggots, crops, huge cornfields. The Shire itself is just... Clearly, that's a deforested area. But, you know, they've knocked down a bunch of trees.
Yeah, I think they're definitely a bit closer in line to being nicer to the environment. They're still destroying things. They're still changing. It's not quite industrialization, but they are terraforming. They're changing how everything works, and they're uprooting native biodiversity. The only ones I feel like in all of Middle Earth who truly live with the land are the elves. And they are very superior and shitty about it, because they're very superior and shitty about themselves. But they do work with the land. They build around the trees. They build with they work with it, not against it.
Yeah. Which is annoying, because I always looked at the Shire. I mean, they are tunneling underground to form their houses, so why are they knocking down all the trees, the hobbits?
True, but I think that's partly because they're in Hobbiton, which is like a district of the Shire, so that's going to be probably more like a rolling hills, more meadowy kind of northern Germany, southern Sweden type environment, or like the Midwest here in the United States. But then you have other parts of the Shire that are closer to the Old Forest that are very heavily forested, and it's a bit of a different ecosystem.
The elves, as you said, seem to be doing a very good job. I mean, they seem to have barely, you know, cut down anything. The worst they're probably doing is just scaring off a lot of native species who associate them with humans.
Probably.
Or do the elves have some special power of communication with animals that I'm not aware of?
They do, to my knowledge. I think Legolas uses that a few times, just instantly befriend horses and things like that. But
okay.
I think that it's less of a very holistic and vegan way of looking at animals, but more of just a more in-tune, empathetic version of it, but they're still consuming meat.
Yeah, okay. Well, so you think that scene in The Hobbit when the dwarves are eating with the elves is just the elves, you know, fucking with the dwarves then?
Probably.
You know, when they sit down, they just serve them, like, leaves and salad, and the dwarves are just looking down at their plates in disgust?
I mean, they probably have more of a healthy outlook on a healthy omnivore diet of, you know, 70 to 90% plant matter and then a little bit of meat to supplement that.
Yeah.
But then the dwarves are very American, and they feel that everything has to be steak. I must eat steak and beer for every meal, and that's what steak and meal and beer is.
Bread and cheese and steak and milk.
The bread's a vegetable. Comes from plants.
The only society I can think of that does a better job than the elves is the ants, but as we know now, they are horrific ambush predators. And by the way, yeah, if anybody doesn't know what we're talking about when it comes to the ants being voracious predators, we did an episode on this way, way back in the day, like 3 years ago, where we posited that the ants were actually animals that just moved so slowly they had plant matter growing off them. And as such, were the perfect ambush predators and could just wait for squirrels and birds to pop into their mouths and then
chomp.
Free snack. But, I mean, look, we've talked about this enough now that, you know, people can see there are some very clear message. Well, I don't know if it's deliberate messaging about environmentalism, but it definitely exists, in Tolkien's world, I would say. And it reminds me a lot of, Margaret Atwood, so the woman who wrote The Handmaid's Tale. She has written The Handmaid's Tale, Alias Grace, The Heart Goes Last, three which have very strong themes about, gender. Particularly feminism, but she has insisted over and over again that she is not a feminist writer. But anybody who's watched The Handmaid's Tale is going to be like, really? Okay.
I
wouldn't have picked it, but...
I've never seen The Handmaid's Tale, but I don't want to. But I've watched... Libby showed the Alias Grace miniseries to me, and I feel like that kind of does to feminism what Lord of the Rings does for environmental messaging, where... It doesn't really beat you over the head with it, but it's presented so plainly and so obviously. We're like, yeah, of course this is like a wrong thing versus a right thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I really feel the same way here. The fact that Tolkien is so anti, there is no allegory, there is no meaning here, but you'd be hard-pressed to not take any meaning from it, I feel.
Yeah.
It's our fault. They should have never given us uniforms if they didn't want us to be an army.
So, we are going to touch more on whether we recommend the film, and whether or not we feel bad for any of the monsters next week. So, what I thought I'd bring up was a really cool comment we got on Ecology for the Masses recently regarding The Lion King. So, as you might remember, we did The Lion King a couple of weeks back, and one of the things that I've always found really frustrating is one of the only examples of something that actually does take me out of the movie in terms of scientific inaccuracy. Is the fact that when the hyenas take over and are suggested to be overpredating on the local area, it turns into a massive desert. And I put this in a blog article a while ago called Ecological Lessons from the Lion King. And we got a comment on it this week, which postulated a new theory from Kyle, who essentially said the explosion of plant life led to a massive unsustainable fuel buildup. Catastrophic burns tore through the landscape and hardened the soil, leading to groundwater depletion. The lack of plant life impacted the local climate, reducing evapotranspiration and cloud formation.
You know, I like it a lot.
Yeah, that's not bad. Thank you very much, Kyle.
Yeah, I feel like it's one of those things where the savanna of Africa has been around long enough that that kind of thing wouldn't just happen so quickly, but... You know, it makes all those things make sense, and they could very well lead from one to another. So, in a very extreme case, that could have been what happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, next week we'll be coming back with part two of our return to the world of Middle-earth and the Lord of the Rings with, ideally, the Baroness and Dave the Vet, and I should be there if my flights aren't delayed and I'm not stuck at, you know, some random airport in the middle of nowhere sleeping on a cot or the floor. But... As you say at the end of every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye-bye.
Legend tells of a ring created by an ancient evil that gave its wearer the power to enslave the world. Believed lost for centuries, it has now been found.
Is it secret? Is it safe?